Pete Price's Sunday Best. Scousers Abroad.
This is Radio City Talk.
Ladies and gentlemen, here's a first. We have got our Scouser Abroad in the studio live. Yep, this late on a Monday morning. He's here. He's over from Sydney. He comes from Western originally. Stephen was born in Western Hospital, and Stephen May is with us right now. Thank you for coming in this late.
Thank you, Pete. Yeah,
because there's no one in here. There's only four of us here, and you've got these magnificent night views over the tower. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, you've made a bit of history. We've done this for a long time. We've never had anybody in live, so that's great at this time of night. So that's fabulous. Right, what made you go to Australia?
So I visited Australia in about 2014. I've got a sister who lives in Sydney, and I finished my training as a clinical psychologist in 2016, and my girlfriend and I were decided to travel, and Sydney was going to be the place that we based ourselves. So in 2017, we moved over there and just decided to stay, I guess. It was a nice city.
It's an expensive city.
Yeah, it is an expensive city, yeah.
How long have you been there now?
So just under 2 years.
So you've seen changes price-wise in that?
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's actually been a downturn in the house prices over the past 6 to 12 months, yeah.
I've never heard about that anywhere at all. That's fantastic. Yeah. That's amazing. Clinical psychology?
Yeah, I'm a clinical psychologist.
What made you take that?
Do you want the long version or the short version?
Let's have the long version.
I guess I was kind of growing up, you know, not far from here. My mum and dad were from, mum was from Garston, dad was from Highton. And I think I saw lots of kind of distress and people struggling around me. I didn't really know what was happening at the time. But as I grew up and once I realized that psychology was a thing that you could study, I found that it was giving me some answers to some of the questions that I had about myself and about the world around me. So I studied my undergrad at the Uni of Liverpool, and I just worked towards clinical psychology over the next few years, moved to London, got some experience. And through that journey came to understand things in a way that was kind of new to me and useful. It helped me to make sense of what's happening or what had happened in the world around me.
Now, people are the same the world over, but what's it like being a clinical psychologist here as opposed to Australia? Is it different?
I think so. I mean, the training here is a little bit different. So you have to do a 3-year undergraduate degree, and usually you work for a little bit of time and then you do a 3-year doctorate in clinical psychology in the UK. In Australia, clinical psychologists do an undergraduate degree and they do a 2-year master's. And because they don't have the healthcare system that we have and the public health services, the experience that people have when they start training as a clinical psychologist is a little bit different. And when they come to practice, it's a little bit different too. So one of the biggest differences that I've noticed is how kind of medicalized the approach to psychology is in Sydney compared to some of what I've seen in the work that I've done over here. And that's something that I'm kind of interested in and passionate about, is other ways of understanding distress that's less medical.
Because life is going the way it is, and because of social media, I mean, this is a fascinating subject, because my phone in for the last 38 years has been about people's problems as well as everything else. And it's been a little bit like, I call myself a priest in a confessional box. Now, I'm not a trained psychologist. I'm not trained as anything, but I've got a degree in life, and I've lived my life, and I've been through an awful lot, and I'm a lot older than you, which gives me that freedom.
Yeah.
Do you think that there's more problems and more people like you are needed because the world's changing?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's an interesting one. I think, I don't know if there are more problems, but maybe the way that we understand problems is changing a little bit, or our willingness to speak about those experiences. It's a more of an, I mean, I'm quite interested in there being less of people like me, actually. And I'm actually interested in how people can cultivate their own communities and find other ways of accessing support, whether that's from within their family system or friend networks or other people that are around them. Because I think there's real value in that. And I think that has been something that's been lost over the past 20 years with the rise of technology and the kind of increased isolation that some people might feel because of because of technology.
Interesting you say that. See, what bothers me about your job, and I hear it, and we get a lot of people complaining there's not enough money in the NHS, they can't get enough people to speak to, they need counselling, etc. I don't see an end to your job. That's what I don't see. If you are counselling me, I don't see where the end is when you say to me, you can go into the big wide world now. Because to me, you become my crutch.
Yeah, and I think that's always... I don't know if risk is the right word, but there's something in that. I mean, I have this idea that whenever I might meet with somebody in therapy, I'm in the context of their life, which is a book. I'm a full stop in a sentence, in a paragraph, in a chapter. You know, it's a small part. And at most, we might meet for an hour or so a week. And that's only ever a small amount of somebody's time that they spend. So I think realistically, it's important to hold that in perspective and to think about where the support, the long-term support might come from. And that's a lot of the work. And one of the reasons why I stayed in Australia is because I've been able to get involved in a way of work, and that involves not just the individual, but their family and networks.
Now, when you went to Australia, were your qualifications all right for you, or did you have to change?
I had to transfer my qualifications to the Australian system, but things were relatively smooth and relatively straightforward. I think because of the quality of training here, it transferred fairly well.
I'm talking to Stephen, who's come into the studio live. It's our first ever Scouser Abroad Live. He's from Australia. He's over here for 5 weeks. He's a clinical psychologist, which I absolutely find fascinating. Your lady friend, your other half, what does she do?
Sarah. So she works as a manager at Groupon. Yeah, she loves
So worlds apart.
Yeah, very different. And in some ways, I mean, we both work with people. And like you said, there's something about what it is to be a person is kind of universal in lots of ways.
Now tell me, because you must analyse an awful lot of things because of what you do. So here's a question I've never asked in a million years, which I think is a great question. The two of you emigrated. Mm-hmm. Did it put pressure on your relationship? Yes, you're both free agents and you're going and you know what you're doing. But, you know, one could get more depressed, the other one could get happier, the one could be homesick. Did it put any pressure on your relationship?
I think there was something about moving to a new city that meant that what we had with each other became more important almost. So one of the things that I struggled with, I mean, I moved over in my early 30s and I was surprised at how hard it was to find kind of like-minded friends initially, and to find a home for some of the things that I was interested in. I do a lot of running and connecting with a group and finding work and things like that. So I think whilst those things were becoming part of our network and our experience, there was an increased pressure on us to kind of figure things out together.
How did the families feel about you going?
So I guess I could speak to my family. I have a sister who's already in Sydney. So she'd kind of eased it for my parents. But it's my mum and dad, and I've got another sister who's here. She's got two babies. I think their sense or their take on it was, we'd rather you didn't go, but we know that you need to do what's right for you and to make the decisions that are for you and your future.
I believe that everybody, and I've said this many times on this programme, that I believe that people who have been to university should take a year gap out, because it makes you a different person. It makes you a different person in life. It gives you life experiences which you can't buy in university, and you can't get in school, and you can't get in a job. And I think it's great. Do you think you'll come back, or do you feel that you might stay?
At the moment, my plan is to stay for another year. And from what I hear of the people who are currently in Sydney from the UK, there's lots of people who say, I came here for 6 months and it's 11 years. So I'm kind of mindful of that and keeping an eye. The thing that I don't want to happen is I don't want to just be there because it's easy and convenient. I want to kind of make a conscious choice about what I do next. But for now, the next year, providing things stay as they are, then I'll be in Sydney.
Have you done any touring in Australia?
Yeah, so I travelled up the coast with one of my friends when I went in 2014, but since I've been there this time, we've been up the coast and down the coast a few times. Been up to Fraser Island over Christmas, which was amazing, and the Whitsundays. So it is incredible scenery. There's lots of amazing things to see.
So you get a client and they go, but you're English. I mean, is it a half-hour conversation before you even start?
Yeah, it's interesting, actually. Some people... I work in three different roles, but in one of the roles that I work in, I have a bio that says that I'm from the UK. And some people have asked to meet with me because I'm from the UK. For some people, that's been because they have a sense that I'm new to the country like they are. So other people who've come over. And I guess there's something about what their perception of what I might be like is. So that's kind of interesting.
Within your job, is there patterns? Are there trends of depression with people?
I mean, lots of people, in some of the work that I do, relationships are part of what people come in and want to talk about. I think for me, the common trend is that everybody has a story and we can understand every person's experience, regardless of how extreme we might perceive their distress to be. So if they might have psychosis or be given a diagnosis of something like schizophrenia, the experience is always understandable in the context of what's happened to them in their life. And that links to what I mentioned at the beginning about these other ways of understanding distress. And rather than meeting with people and saying, what's wrong with you? What diagnosis can we give you? I think that increasingly we should be asking people, what's happened to you? What's your story? And who's around you? Who's important to you in your life?
How do you not take your job home with you?
Well, I guess I don't think that I always manage that. I think sometimes it does come home with me. I feel really fortunate to have my girlfriend to be able to talk to have friends and family for support. Obviously, I can't talk about what's happened in work, but I can talk about the impact that it's had on me. And clinical psychologists are generally well supported as a profession. So we get lots of supervision during training and are encouraged to continually meet in supervision sessions to think about our experiences. But I think it's something that I'll continually have to think about how I best do this. Going for runs helps as well. I do lots of running.
Interesting you say that. Once again, I've been doing this for many years. I have bouts of depression because of the life I've had. And I find that going to a gym is one of the best things in the world. I swim now. I can't run because I've done my knees in. Mm. But I think it's a great way of getting rid of tension.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think there's something about, I mean, most people will talk about the hit of endorphins, but there's something for me about the ritual and routine of going through the motions and having space where there isn't technology because I'm often on my phone and things like that.
So I'm talking to Stephen, who is from Sydney over here. Is your lady with you or is she still there?
She's here. We're both back for, Sarah's going to two weddings. I'm going to three over the Yeah.
I love that. I love that. Now tell me, so you meet some Australians, you're in a bar having a drink in Sydney. As soon as they find out what you do for a living, do they talk to you like they would talk to a police person, to a doctor? Yeah. Funny you should mention that. I've got this problem.
Yeah.
Do you get that?
Usually people say a couple of things. Either they'll say, are you going to analyse me? Or do you know what I'm thinking? Like they're the kind of stock standard. In fact, I wrote my friend and I, Amanda, wrote a book about how to become a clinical psychologist, and we dedicated a section to myth busting because we felt sometimes fed up with having those questions of, are you an analyst? You know, can you tell what I'm thinking? It's interesting, actually, as to who asks those questions. But sometimes the follow up is that people will say things like, hey, can I tell you about this thing that's happened? Which is sometimes a bit of a mixed bag because on one hand, I'm not there for that at that moment, but at the same time it sometimes makes me feel, I guess, sad that that is the only time when that person might have an opportunity to talk about this.
I love the myth busting. I think that's I've just written that down. That just made me laugh. That did. Give us some more myth busts.
So they were the two that we went for. I think the big ones were, are you an analyst, and are you gonna can you tell what I'm thinking? What are the other myth busts? I think there are some common, I mean, for me, there are bigger kind of ways that we understand human experiences. You know, this idea of mental illnesses as a disease that's similar to physical health diseases. That isn't my perspective. It's not to say that people don't experience distress and that's not very painful. I understand that. And I think that, yeah, that is true. I guess the one of the challenges is that when we take that assumption that it's similar to a disease, it means that we have to label that disease and we have to sometimes give medications for that disease. And although they're sometimes part of the problem and the solution, I don't think that they're everything. And I think they can mask some of the other things that go on in people's lives and, you know, their lived experience, as you mentioned, that are so important in understanding how to be useful.
It's interesting, and I've talked about this many times and it's been written about, but I had the aversion therapy for being cured of being gay. And the only reason I'm mentioning that is I think at my age now, I've done very well. I've come through that without any help, without any analyst or anything. Yeah. But I think of other people. I'm sorry to be so serious about this, but it's so fascinating. I've never had somebody come all the way from Australia that we can talk like this. But it is... Because in the before you were born, the Second World War, the First World War, there was nobody to analyse people there. Mm. They had to just get on with it. It's changed, hasn't it, the world?
Yeah, it has changed. And clinical psychology is a young profession. It was, I think, the initial meetings that they had with this idea of this new profession or applying these ideas of psychology to understanding people's experiences was post-World War II because of the lack of support. And I think things are changing a lot and it's great that they are. I think there's still a way to go with lots of things. And I'm so grateful that we don't have things like aversion therapy. But we do still have some, in my mind, unethical ways of responding to people's distress, like electroconvulsive therapy and things like that, which I think have some questionable ethics. And the evidence is also questionable with those as well. So I think we have to keep thinking about where we're moving to as well as noticing where we've been and where we come from.
Now, we've just spoke for 18 minutes and it's been quite serious. Are you a fun guy as well?
Well, I don't know.
Are you always this serious?
I don't know if I'm the best person to answer that one.
Analyze yourself and tell me.
I think, I do like having fun. I mean, people often... I think sometimes my girlfriend thinks that sometimes I take things a bit too seriously. It's hard to switch off some of the ways of thinking.
Absolutely.
But yeah, I like having fun. In fact, I went to the theatre. It's been great being back in the city. I went to the theatre on Friday to see Lost Soul 2.
Which that was an experience for you as a clinical psychologist.
Yeah, it was great. And I grew up with Motown music was what my mum listened to. And my dad listened to Eric Clapton, things like that. I love music. So I guess that's part of the fun side.
Do you like coming back?
Yeah, I do. I was thinking earlier that there's something about... One of my favourite quotes is Kipling's What Do They Know of England Who Only England Know? And I think there's something about going to another place and coming back that gives a fresh perspective. In fact, I said to my dad earlier, he's got some time off on Tuesday, that we should go to the Beatles museum or the tour that they have, because it's something that, being from the city, we never really took advantage of. So it's great to be back and kind of see things afresh.
Well, it's a very sensible idea, that, because I once did it. I did the tour, and it's like, if you live in London, you don't look at Buckingham Palace. So I think it's great. And if you go down to the Beatles museum, down at the Albert Dock, the Beatles story, if you go into the pretend cavern they built and look on the right hand side, you'll see a big piece about me, because I was the first person to raise money to build the first ever Beatles statue when you were a child. That's scary. That, so you'll see the picture of me with a beard and moustache like you, and long hair. So that's a great
idea. Keep an eye out for that.
What would you say to people, and I could talk all night here now, you're a fascinating man, but what would you say to people that are on the brink of doing what you've done? We ask this question of everybody because it is a big step. People do come back and are terribly, terribly homesick, but some have the best life in the world. What would you say to people who are on the edge?
Yeah. So if they're thinking about moving to Australia, I think
Or anywhere.
Yeah.
Anywhere.
I think that maybe the generation that I'm part of, or younger generations, have more freedom than there's ever been. You know, we can fly anywhere and it's relatively affordable. I'd say if people have an opportunity to do it, then go for it. I mean, you can always come back.
And that's the big thing when you're young.
Yeah.
You can always come back. And of course, now we're living in a different world because we've got social media. You've got Skype. You've got so many ways of being in touch.
Yeah. I mean, I've been able to know my niece and nephew who are now 3 and 2 whilst I've been away because we've been able to FaceTime or Skype them, which is awesome. So I think the world feels smaller maybe than it used to. So yeah, I'd say go for it. And I think there's something about what you mentioned earlier about the lived experience and going to new places, trying new things, that is just, I don't know, it's kind of good. Yeah, it feels good
absolutely.
For me. Yeah.
How did you find Christmas in the heat?
It doesn't feel like Christmas. It feels the run up. There's something about growing up in England and the north of England where as the temperature changes and as it gets cooler and it's bonfire night and Halloween and all those things, that for me, I didn't realize, but is a real cue into Christmas is coming. And so having things get warmer and then gradually wearing less and less clothes to be outside, just it didn't feel like Christmas. And in fact, when we're going back towards the end of July, we're going to go and celebrate Christmas in July, which is a thing that happens in Australia. Because the temperature changes, people start to feel kind of, maybe it's more expats actually, but generally there's a
Christmas in July.
Yeah, Christmas in July. So, well, what we're going to do, we're going to go up the coast to Port Macquarie, and it'll be a colder time of year, obviously, because it's winter. And the place where we're staying has a log fire. They'll cook Christmas dinner for us. They'll play Christmas songs for one day. Yeah, which...
And do lots of people do this?
Well, it's something... It's a thing. Yeah, people have mentioned it. We didn't do it last year because we were over in the UK again last year visiting home. But yeah, it's something... I wonder if it's people who are from the Northern Hemisphere are more likely to do that because I think those associations with colder temperature meaning Christmas and winter.
And of course Father Christmas needs the cold weather because of his attire with the reindeers. Yeah. I can't believe you're going to be celebrating. I think that is very funny. I've never heard that before.
Yeah,
Stephen, you're a fascinating man. So have you analysed me?
No, I don't do it unless I'm paid to.
No. Now you're going to get home safe.
Yeah.
Steve Mayers, thank you so much for coming in.
All right, thanks, Pete. Cheers.
Pete Price's Sunday Best. Scousers Abroad.
This is Radio City Talk.